uma com a boca. حرام التزي يترك تزلي حرام التزلي يا امك وابوك حرام العرب يحكمهم بالاعدام حرام الولغيال يجوزوك.
Welcome back, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Let's now turn to the subject of the ongoing struggle in Syria between a dictator and his people who are rising up against him, risking their lives for freedom. I'm now joined by Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy in the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Pleasure to be here.
And, of course, the Assad political dynasty, since the son took over from the father, Assad, Arabic for line, I guess they chose that name, right? Like Stalin chose his
It was chosen for them, and I guess it was a fairly apt name, but it has positive connotations in that part of the world, I think.
And just, we were speaking earlier, just I'd be interested in your comments on this with Juan Cole, about not just NATO's inability to protect the freedom fighters in Libya against this ruthless dictator, but also generally posing the question about this apparent paradox with the European left and the American left, who supported, as you recall, the Sandinistas People Army against Somoza, who was a terrible dictator. But here you have a true people's army fighting an even more ruthless dictator and his billionaire brat sons. And there doesn't appear to be any support. Do you understand, or do you have any comments on that paradox?
Well, with regard to Syria, it's any country, including the United States, acts in its national interest, and sometimes that doesn't jive particularly well with ideology or national values. But the problem with Syria, as opposed to Libya, is that it's in a much more strategic part of the Middle East, bordering Israel, and then, of course, bordering on Iraq, which has already had its problems, and also Lebanon, which has its problems. And I think the fear from the Obama administration, as well as the Israelis, the Jordanians, and the Saudis, is that the ideal situation is for the Syrian government and Bashar al-Assad to enact real reform and move forward while providing that stability in Syria, rather than a precipitous fall from power, which might cause instability, and because Syria is like Lebanon and Iraq, politically and religiously diverse, and so if the political center is removed, there might be a great deal of political chaos, and that might pour over into the borders of other countries. So it's a delicate balancing act, and I think so far the Obama administration has certainly disappointed in the level of reforms that the Syrian government has announced, and they're hoping that they do more so that a situation a la Libya or something else doesn't happen.
Well, this is obviously a Chinese curse. May you live in interesting times. This is an interesting time to examine the kind of paradoxes and inconsistency of realpolitik, in the sense that our foreign policy has often been predicated upon not acting according to our ideals, but acting in our so-called interests. And in a curious way, in many ways, what's happening now in the Middle East would indicate, at least in the case of Egypt and in the case of Libya, that acting according to our ideals may well be more in our national interest. And that's one of the things that I find puzzling about the lack of support for the Libyan rebels. But your point is well taken about Syria, that it is obviously one of those cases where realpolitik may sway things more than our ideals. And it's certainly pretty flagrant, isn't it, in Bahrain, where we are not supporting the democratic aspirations of the majority of the people because of our base there with the Fifth Fleet.
Right. Yeah, no, exactly. And, we're in danger of, being on the wrong side of history in any case. And the same sort of information revolution that's sweeping across the Middle East is also informing everyone of the inconsistencies, I think, in U.S. foreign policy, not just now but in the past. And if a government is or a movement is in the interest of the United States, we'll support it. If not, then we won't. But that's traditionally been the case. But I think those days are over, because the populations and throughout the Middle East, as we're seeing, with this information revolution and social media, the regimes and the authoritarian regimes cannot control the stream of information anymore as they used to do. I mean, it used to be in the Arab world in the past when there was a internal coup. The coup plotters would take over the radio station and the TV station before they even overthrew the government, so they could control the stream of information. Then they keep tight hold of it, as long as they were in power. It'd be state TV and state radio and limited press freedoms. That's no longer the case. And these governments have been reluctant to open up politically in terms of press freedoms. And people, don't want to be treated as subjects anymore. They want to be citizens.
So where do we come down, though, with Assad, who, my feeling, and I think just following from what you've just said, David Lesh, is that what's different about the Arab Spring is that the aspirations that are shared by these tech-savvy young people who are risking their lives and taking to the streets against these ossified dictatorships is pretty universal, the what's happening in terms of the revolutionaries. The differences are with the dictators and how ruthless they're prepared to be. And it's worth noting, during the Egyptian situation, that it was the Saudi king, who we often refer to as a reformer, that was calling Barack Obama every day and screaming at him, saying, "You've got to let Mubarak shoot those students in Tahrir Square, otherwise they're going to lose it." So we eventually sided with them, and we have sided with the Libyan people against their dictator, who was our recent friend. And where do we stand on Assad? Because on the surface, you would think the U.S. would be perfectly happy to get rid of this guy whose best friend is our worst enemy, the Iranian regime.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Syrians have had a fairly sclerotic, foreign policy and relationship with the United States over the years. In some cases, they've worked with the U.S. They've negotiated directly in good terms with the Israelis on numerous occasions, and they participated in the 1991 Gulf War on the side of the U.S.-led coalition. They've been able to play both sides of the fence. And I think what the Bush administration said was, to Syria, was that you have to choose which side you want to be on. Either it's on the Hezbollah Iran side or it's on our side. And the Syrians, Syria is a fairly weak country, and so they felt that they chose one side, they'd give up all of these assets that to them provide them with leverage in order to deal with Israel and negotiations to get the Golan Heights back, in order to deal with the United States. So we're still hoping. I've met with Bashar al-Assad a number of times over the years, and he has reformed the country in terms of economic reform, monetary, fiscal reform, educational reform. He realizes he needs to find a niche in the international global economic system. He needs to improve Syria, but of course, political reform has lagged far behind. And I'm fearing that the institutional inertia in Syria is just unable to cope with the demands and expectations of this new revolutionary movement in the Middle East, and that's now hit Syria. And they're just moving too slow, and that's the way Syria does things, very incrementally. Bashar al-Assad is certainly in control, but he doesn't have absolute authority. He has to bargain, negotiate, manipulate with various pockets of resistance and established interests in order to get even the smallest things done. And I know it's very frustrating to him, and what's disappointing to me is that he could have seized the moment a week ago in that much-anticipated speech and gotten ahead of the curve and created, because he's fairly popular in the country, and he could have leveraged that popularity to create a critical mass of support for real reform, rather than allow what seems to be happening now, a critical mass of opposition arising that will make anything but the removal of the regime unacceptable. And I think there's still a window of opportunity. I know the United States is hoping, that he really implements reform, lifting the emergency law and a number of other things, and really doing it and implementing mounting these things.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and the author of The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. But it still seems very, very paradoxical to me, David Lesh, that the United States would rather this dictator stay in power. The Israelis, I understand, want him to stay in power. They're afraid of what might happen if democracy breaks out in Syria, and what kind of government will emerge there. I understand that the Turks to the north, their foreign minister apparently off the record recently said they're really concerned about it, and they want stability down there. They don't want democracy. So it seems like in the neighborhood there's this realpolitik going on.
Yeah, it's definitely the case, and the U.S. seems to be following along. And, you know, Turkey has improved its relationship with Syria tremendously, especially in an economic sense over the years. So, you know, they don't want to cut off their nose to spite their face. And the Israelis, as you said, and others, you know, if the Assad regime should fall, there's no telling, you know, what type of replacement will come in. And will it be an Islamist type of regime? Will it be just political chaos in a very strategic area? Or, you know, a democracy coming in doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a more moderate or pro-U.S. type of regime. And that's one of the things I think the U.S. has to live with, is that just because it's a democratic country doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be, you know, following our line of thought on foreign policy and other matters. But, you know, again, it's going to reach a point where the Assad regime, I think, is going to have to really implement reform in a serious way and set presidential term limits, you know, which is tough to do. You know, an authoritarian leader, when they come into power, even with the best of intentions, it's an aphrodisiac. Power is an aphrodisiac, and they fall in love with it, and they have people around them telling them that the well-being of the country is synonymous with their staying in power and well-being, and then you have this slew of established interests that are co-opted by the regime. So it's very difficult to have a peaceful transition to democracy from an authoritarian system, but I'm afraid that's what he's going to have to do. And I've been saying all along that he can create a more lasting legacy, positive legacy in Syria by giving up that which he's grown most comfortable with—that is power.
And have you said that to his face?
No, I actually I've been writing about it and saying it on programs such as this, and. I have communicated it to Syrian officials. I don't know whether it got to Bashar al-Assad, but I'm hoping that it does. But there are many other voices, I'm sure, stronger voices close to him that are saying quite the opposite.
Right. Well, that's the system that he's created, though, isn't it? A patronage system. When you say he's got to reform the economy is a patronage system. It's a trickle-down system. And that's why the people that support him, you see them driving through the streets of Damascus with portraits of him. They're the people that are the winners in that country. But the majority are the losers, right?
Well, and there have been a great deal of economic reform, fiscal, monetary reform, making the country more investment friendly from the outside. But it's tended to concentrate in a small elite, and so that the gap between that elite and the uneven distribution of wealth between that small group and the rest of the country has grown larger and larger. And you can see that when you visit Damascus. You know, there the tourist end has risen. High-end boutique shopping and hotels and restaurants are for and can be only, you know, bought by or purchased by a small elite. And so there's a veneer of economic growth due to these policies, but behind that is uneven distribution of wealth, which is, you know, one of the foundations of the socioeconomic problems, which is fueling the uprising, in addition to a whole set of other grievances in terms of lack of political space and political repression and so forth.
So, give us a sense then, Dr. David Lesh, of the other factors. For the longest time, political scientists have said, well, this is a, and you know, the neoconservatives who brought the Iraq War always thought that Bashar al-Assad was low-hanging fruit, that somehow they could pick him off. And, you know, they've proven to be serially wrong at every turn. But the understanding that he's an Alawite, which is a Shia sect of 15% minority sect in an 85% Sunni country. That's always been cited as a vulnerability of his. Has that come up?
Yeah, it has. I mean, it's a situation where, you know, they've tried to emphasize the secular nature of the country. I mean, it is a Ba'ath party, which at least used to be socialist and thoroughly secular, and tried to emphasize that aspect so that the religious differences or the sectarian differences in Syria are somewhat muted as a result and do not come up. In fact, one of the things Bashar said in an interview last June in the Charlie Rose show, you know, when he asked Bashar, what's your biggest challenge? And he said to keep the country secular in a region where, you know, more traditional conservative Islamic movements are seen to be rising. And what seems to have happened is that, quite to the contrary, what has been rising over the past few months are more populist and, for the most part, secular movements. And one thing that Bashar al-Assad did this past week, which I was concerned about, is that he started to move back to the right again toward the Islamic side of things in Syria to ameliorate some of the opposition from especially some of the Sunni Muslims and Sunni Muslim religious clerics in Syria. That's some of the same stuff that Mubarak did and some others in trying to placate the Islamist side. You restrict and shrink the political space of the secular democratic elements. And I hope that's not what he's doing. I think it might have been a short-term type of maneuver to dissuade those from going and protest on, you know, Friday mosque and get the Sunni imams to give relatively benign sermons at the Friday mosque day. But I hope he's not going in that direction. It seems to be a mishmash. I mean, there was one Syrian official some years ago during the height of the deteriorating relations with the United States, and they asked that Syrian official, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to lash out? Are you going to make concessions to the United States? Or are you going to do something in between? And the Syrian official said, we're going to do all three. And that's kind of how the way Syria does things, which makes it difficult to read. They follow a variety of policies, and they tend to follow which one works the best, and they try to work both sides of the fence and inside and outside of Syria. But that doesn't work all the time. You know, they muddle through things, but this is a situation I don't think they can muddle through. They're going to have to come forward and move forward in one particular direction. I hope it's in the direction of reform rather than repression.
Well, Dr. David Lesh, apparently they've recognized that the Assad regime recognized that they had to deal with the Kurds. So the Kurds in the north have been pretty restive, and they've never been given citizenship. And now he's making moves to cut them off from joining the opposition. How's that working?
Well, you know, again, the devil's in the details, and it's always in terms of implementation. Certainly, he's trying to head off, you know, the Kurdish opposition element. You can see him with the what I just mentioned, trying to head off, ameliorate, placate perhaps an Islamist opposition in order to isolate perhaps the democracy activists and other elements in society that have different sets of grievances based on different issues so that they can be isolated and more easily controlled. So that, you know, that's a typically, a Syrian way of doing things, and particularly under the Assad regime, both father and son, is sort of divide and rule. Giving Kurds or promising them citizenship is a good thing in the long term if it's combined with other political reforms. So lifting the emergency law is a good thing if they actually do it, and if they don't replace it by something that's the same thing by a different name. So again, the devil's in the details and implementation. And it's one thing to announce things; it's another thing to implement these things in a fully integrated reform paradigm that I think needs to happen in Syria, and which I think, you know, Bashar can still do. But his window of opportunity before he loses, the big chunk of goodwill that he has in the country and in the region will be totally lost.
So just in closing then, Dr. David Lesh, he The Muslim Brotherhood, which is often cited as the nightmare alternative to Bashar al-Assad, and when you say on Charlie Rose he talked about his greatest challenge was to maintain the secular nature of the state, of course that's what Gaddafi's been saying too, and warning against Al Qaeda. So it's hard to know how much these dictators are posturing in order to justify their dictatorships, but. My understanding is the Muslim Brotherhood was all but wiped out, and they're not a big factor. And I take it that's what the Israelis are afraid of. What do you think would be the face of the democratic opposition if they were able to take over? And I think it's worth making clear to our audience that nobody seems to be supporting the democratic opposition. The Israelis, the Americans, or the Turks in the neighborhood. They all want this dictatorship to continue. They just want it to burnish its image a little.
I think what might come into being would be certainly a Sunni-dominated government, since it is about 75% of the country, and I think it the Sunni business community, which is which has been a very powerful sector of society in Syria, largely allied with the regime, with the Alawite regimes of the past, and they've been able to co-opt and bring into power many of the Sunni business community. And Bashar al-Assad has done a pretty good job bringing in Sunnis into the leading positions in the government as well, but I think that's the shape it would take, and I believe that it would be secular, because as you said, the Muslim Brotherhood was pretty much wiped out. There is kind of a Salafist movement in Syria that was resuscitated somewhat during the Iraq War, when Syria was facilitating the movement of jihadists and insurgents into Iraq. And there could be some blowback regarding that, especially if there is political instability. I mean, I don't think there's going to be an organized Islamist movement coming to power in Syria, but if there is political instability, it could be taken advantage of by a number of different groups that are inimical to U.S. interests or Israeli interests. That's the big question. If the center is removed, because it's been there so long and it's controlled so many aspects of society, as we saw in Iraq, when the center was removed, the country tended to implode. We hope that if that happens, the implosion will not happen in Syria, but there is that fear. And so I think the lesser of many evils, as the Israelis say, better the devil you know, is to keep the current regime in power and to compel them to reform in the way that they need to do.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. David Lesh.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, a History, and The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. We'll take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Republicans appear to have won the budget battle, and that the Democrats appear to be silent, feckless, useless, and mute.
يكفي تقول لي بس
بس
ايش معرفك بالحب
ايوه
ايمت صرت تحس
انا
ايش معرفك بالحب ايمت صرت تحس
هص بس اسمع هص